Today, at least, we want to look at some alternative methods of finding energy. I think we're all aware that the energy that we have been using in the last 100 years has practically all been fossil fuels, and that the fossil fuels are being depleted at a very quick rate, and that when they're gone, of course, they're gone, and we'll have to either live without energy or find some alternate ways to get the energy we use. At any rate, the days of cheap fuel, I think, are gone for good, and whatever energy we use in the future, it's going to cost us more. Also, we must save the fossil fuels we have for a better use. We can't waste gasoline and these very complicated hydrocarbons, just burning them up to get a little heat. That's real waste. In Genesis 1:28, you know, God says to subdue the earth and have dominion over all living things, and some people have stopped reading it at that point and say, okay, just use up the earth. In that same verse, he also says that we are supposed to replenish the earth. And certainly I take that to mean that we are to use things wisely and not waste energy. Also, the future is going to hold some drastic changes, I think, in lifestyles. That energy is going to be just not there, and we'll have to get more into walking and biking and pastimes that don't use as much energy, living in maybe a colder home or closer to work or all sorts of things. But I really believe that will be a change in our lifestyles. However, I also claim that this probably is for the better, that we'll, I think it's better for our bodies and our mind and our soul. I think we'll move closer to God as we have to not have so much conspicuous consumption as we've been having in these days. Although I'm sure that for some Americans especially, it's going to be very painful when you get away from just buying everything and using things up. But at any rate, today then I'd like to look at a few of the alternate energy sources we might look to in the future. And next week I'll have a series of 5 talks, I believe, on other types of energy that we might use too. If you have any questions as we go along, be sure to ask. I know we have some energy experts here that probably should be giving the talk instead of me. But any questions so far? Comments? Well, first we'd like to look at wind. The use of the wind for energy was first done, we believe, in Persia back in the 7th century. They built stationary stone buildings that collected the prevailing winds. They couldn't be rotated like a windmill now, so the wind had to be coming from a certain direction, and they used them for grinding their grain and whatnot. European farms started using wind for energy in about the 11th century, and we're certainly familiar with the sailing ships that used the wind exclusively up into the 1800s and until steam engines came along in the latter part of the 1800s. And even when the steam engines came, of course, they used at that time wood to fire them up. So they were using a renewable resource too. It wasn't a fossil fuel that was going to be depleted. Although they pretty well used up the woods pretty fast for that purpose, but at any rate, it was a renewable resource. I think we're familiar with the windmills on the farms in the United States. And they worked fine for pumping water, because you could pump it whenever the wind was blowing and you didn't have to pump it at the moment the cattle were drinking the water. And some farmers, of course, used it to generate electricity, and mainly until REA came into being and electrified most farms. So side lights, some people have pointed out that Stalin and Roosevelt both had electricity as one of their prime parts of their programs, to electrify the farms. As far as larger generators go on wind, they have been tried in the past. In 1941, at Grandpa's Knob in Vermont, they had a 1.25 megawatt generator. Now, that might not mean anything to you. What does 1.25 megawatts mean? Well, I think the easiest way to estimate the size of plants is to compare them to a nuclear plant, whether you like nuclear or not. At least everybody has some idea what they are. And most nuclear plants are about 1,200 megawatts. The Trojan plant, for instance, down by in Oregon, Washington border. So that a 1.25 megawatt plant, then it would take about 1,000 of these windmills to produce the electricity that a Trojan would do. Now, of course, a windmill doesn't operate all the time, so that's if it's running.
Neither does Trojan.
And neither does Trojan. But you can probably estimate that a windmill will operate about 25% of the time. So you'd need about 1,000 of those. Well, it was working fine until a big windstorm. Well, they were having trouble feathering it. Problems with windmills is they don't operate if the wind isn't strong enough, which is bad, but not as bad as if the wind gets too strong. Then you have to feather them some way so that they don't blow away. Well, this one blew away, or at least the blade blew about a mile, and they never built it up again. Currently, if you're from Washington, you might have driven by Goldendale. There are three big wind generators being put up, and one or two of them have been operating near Goldendale, and Boeing is doing this for the Department of Energy, and these are about 2.5 megawatts, so it'd take about 500 of those to make the equal of a big nuclear plant. They're having problems too. One of them somehow got away from them in a strong wind, and I think it burned out the generator or something. They didn't get it feathered in time. So they aren't operating currently either, but they are working on them. And the main problem has been that they can't produce electricity cheap enough yet. It's still more expensive than producing it some other way. Well, about 2% of the sun's energy that strikes the earth, and we'll be talking about solar next Monday or Tuesday, gets converted into wind energy. And it's that energy, of course, then that we try to catch. And a good windmill can catch about 35% of the wind, of the energy that is in the wind. But, of course, you'd like steady winds. You don't want gusty winds and strong winds, but steady and not too strong. The places that you can do that, of course, are limited. And once you put a windmill up, you're not sure, well, a small one, it doesn't affect much. But if you start putting these up in big banks, maybe it's going to affect the wind for other areas, too. And it might change things. Well, some of the other problems, of course, are that wind does not blow when you want it, necessarily. That if you're using it to generate electricity, what do you do when the wind stops? One suggestion is that, well, maybe you can have windmills over a large area, and the law of averages says maybe the wind ought to be blowing someplace and have them interconnected, but then you have all kinds of power lines you have to hook up, and also some people don't like windmills, they say they don't look nice. And, of course, if you need 1,000 of them, or 500 to get the equivalent of one nuclear plant or one large coal plant. Most big electric plants, whether they're nuclear or coal or whatever, are usually about of the same size. So they usually run about the equivalent of 1,000 megawatt or 1,200 megawatts. I guess I mentioned that it's still more expensive than electricity produced other ways. Some of the other drawbacks are just the land use, that it does take a lot of land, or you'd have to have an awful lot of them. Okay, before I go on to geothermal, anybody any comments, remarks about wind power?
Windmills, are they very noisy?
Yeah, I haven't been right up to the when they've been operating down at Goldendale, but most of them are. They have some noise, yeah. The small ones, the Jacob, I believe it was, the Jacob wind generator that was so popular before REA came in. Most of those had about a 1.5 kilowatt rating. Now, what's 1.5 kilowatts? A kilowatt is 1,000 watts, and a light bulb is usually a 100 watt bulb, and you can have 40, 60 or whatever, but a 100 watt bulb is a common thing, so a kilowatt would be enough to light 100 light bulbs. So if they had a 1.5 kilowatt, 10 light bulbs. So if you had a 1.5 kilowatt, you could get 15 light bulbs lit. That's about what the usual generators that you had on the farm windmills would do. Of course, the other problem there is that you, again, can only produce it when the wind is blowing, so you either need a big battery system or something to store it.
So several months ago, Popular Science carried a fairly good report on small windmills that are available for various needs. I don't remember exactly just all the details on it, but I think there's a lot of hope for small usages of wind like that.
Especially if you are in a remote location where running in power lines is an expensive thing. Well, like up here at Holden, only we don't use the wind here, we use hydro. But if you're in a remote location, then you can use the wind. It's extremely effective. What I was going to say about if you were to get the equivalent of a large electric plant then, a megawatt plant, if you're only getting 1 kilowatt, if you're going to get a megawatt plant or 1,000 or 1,000,000 kilowatts, you'd need a million of these things around to get the equivalent of a large plant. So when you start looking at it that way, it doesn't seem quite as feasible for certain things, but it sure would help if you could do it in certain cases. Also, how much electricity do we usually use? Well, the rule of thumb is that you need a kilowatt per person, so that a Trojan plant or a large electrical producing plant, a megawatt, would be enough then for about 1,000,000 people. So that one of these Jacobs wind generators would generate about the equivalent of what one person uses. Now, if you're on the farm, you probably aren't using that much for one person, because in general, when they say for a city of 1,000,000 you need a big plant, they're assuming that there's industry and other things that are using electricity.
Has there been any dangers with ice collecting on windmills? I know that's a thing in Minnesota where there's a safety concern that people are aware of. It's just in the wintertime, this ice collects on the blades and can be thrown off and that type of thing.
Well, I'm not up on that. I don't know.
Maybe that wouldn't be a concern out here if it's wetter and it rains more or something.
No, it wouldn't be on the other side of the mountains. On this, Goldendale, they get some cold there. I don't know. It's drier there, of course. But the blades on the generators at Goldendale are 300 feet long. Now, that's the length of a football field, you see. So you got a pretty good-sized blade. And I do have some slides of that that I'll show in one of my other presentations when I have a slide projector.
And then farmers, if they have a windmill and they produce more electricity than they use, can they sell, like, I know in Minnesota the power companies have to buy it back from them. Is that how it runs out here too?
Yes, they do have to. However, they don't have to buy it back at a real expensive rate.
No, it's a cheaper rate.
They do.
Okay.
What is it? You can just run it into the power grid, general power grid?
Yes, in fact, there is legislation now that if somebody is producing more electricity, any plant, if you have your own generation, if you're producing more than you use, the electric company has to buy it from you.
So that means that you don't have the problem of storage then. If you have access to the general power grid, you can just run it back into that, and then in a sense you're using them as your reservoir, aren't you, of energy?
Yes, but I believe it works that you still have to buy what you buy from them at their rate.
Yeah.
And they buy it whatever the buying rate is, so you're losing there.
Yeah. They have trouble though, small units, you've got to be able to match the frequency and voltage, and that becomes very expensive.
Yes, for a small outfit, getting the equipment so that you can actually match everything up to them doesn't make it worthwhile.
Yes.
But if you have a fairly large operation.
But would that be prohibitively expensive, so that you couldn't give that any consideration at all? does anyone have any idea what the cost?
I don't know what the cost of the equipment would be. I'm not up on it.
It depends on how tolerant the power company is. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, you're going to have to spend a fair amount of money in order to satisfy them that you're not putting harmonics in their system, that you're in the same frequency wavelength that they are.
When you say a fair amount of money, are you talking several hundreds of thousands of dollars, or are you talking in tens of thousands of dollars? Or
I think you're talking at least in tens of thousands.
Uh-huh.
But it depends, again, on your particular utility. Some utilities will tolerate in their system, depending on where you are, like we're just serving homes with a lot of resistive load. Mm-hmm. They will tolerate, you know, a lot more divergence. Other power companies, just the way the system's set up, they won't tolerate much getting off frequency. You're talking a few milliseconds off frequency.
Mm-hmm.
They want to match really close.
If you're interested in some books on some of these, the bookstore here at Holden Village has an excellent little book on wind energy and things you yourself can, mm-hmm. can do. They also have some real good books over there on solar and making your own hydro plant, all kinds of. They have some real good books down there. And also, I should mention that there's a book, there's several books on reserve in the library over next to Koinonia. One is the Global 2000 Report, which has looks at the whole energy situation and more than just the energy situation, but food and everything, and projects what might happen and what will probably be available. And also there's two books there, one called Muddling Towards Frugality, which I'll sort of be talking about one day next week, and another one, Awakening from the American Dream, which again is about the energy situation and what we've been doing. And that one is for sale in the bookstore here also. It's in a paperback that you might be interested in. I encourage you to take a look at. Okay, anything else on wind? Well, another possibility, of course, is geothermal. And I'm not, anybody here from Klamath Falls, Oregon, or Northern California? At any rate, I think we're aware of what we mean by geothermal, that there is heat in the earth, that for about every 100 feet you go down in the earth, the temperature rises about 1 degree Fahrenheit. So if you go down 15,000 feet, you are down to where it's 150 degrees warmer than it usually, approximately, than what it is on the surface. Now, that's the rule of thumb. However, we certainly are aware from St. Helens and a few other places that you don't have to go down too far, and you can hit a lot of heat sometimes, and such as in Yellowstone. And there are other places, in particular, place called the Geysers in Northern California, which is north of San Francisco. There they have operating a plant that generates electricity, and they're currently generating about 3/4 the capacity of a large electrical installation of a nuclear plant, say. They're getting 600-700 megawatts of power from steam. And what they do is drill down into the rocks and soil, usually the rocks, the porous rocks down there, and there are places where there's actually steam. And they are lucky enough to hit a place where they have dry steam, and the dry steam comes up, and they just run a steam turbine just like you would in a steam plant. Whether you've gotten your steam from nuclear power or coal or oil or whatever, here they just get the steam, and so the earth is their boiler. And it makes for very good energy that way. Now, this is being done other places. They started it in the Geysers about 1960 and have been building up their capacity and to where they're now about 600-800 megawatts. In Lardarello, Italy, way back in 1904, they drilled into a steam source and had electricity that way. And they have about the same capacity there right now. Other places, New Zealand has about 150 megawatt plant. There are some in Japan, Mexico, Russia, Iceland. What's the name of the capital of Iceland?
Reykjavik.
However you say it. They generate electricity there, and they heat their homes too. Another place in the United States where geothermal is used rather than just for electricity is Klamath Falls, Oregon. Oregon Technical Institute, I believe it's called, is the college there. and that is completely heated by geothermal. They just drill down and hit hot water and pump the hot water up and heat, use it for hot water heat for the whole campus and other buildings in town too. Boise, Idaho, a lot of the homes and some of the the state buildings down along the river, they're heated by geothermal. So it's a good source of energy if you're in the right place. And there are a lot of places in the United States that are promising on this. A good friend of mine is a geothermal consultant and has been in charge of drilling wells in Oregon. And they're drilling, these are test wells just to see, and some of the oil companies, the contract is with Sun Oil, they're getting into this too. They're getting up leases on land because they figure there's a good possibility there. However, the dry steam, where you actually get steam coming out, that seems to be very few places that you're going to run into that. Well, the next best thing then is getting extra hot water, superheated water, because water, well, we know that up here, water boils at a lower temperature than it does down at sea level. And as you go into the earth, it boils at higher temperatures, so that the water down in the ground then is hotter than, it's still water, but it's hotter than boiling. So as you bring it out, then you're at sea level or whatever level you are, it'll flash into steam because it's going to boil when it gets there. So you can hit hot water and then flash it into steam and again run it through a steam turbine. And hopefully it'd be nice if you could use the leftover hot water. Of course, that's the same problem with any steam generator, you know, that when you generate electricity in a steam plant, you've lost two-thirds of the energy because you can only get about a third of the steam into the energy in the turbine, and then you have to cool all that water down again to recirculate it. And if you could use all that heat that's in that water, you could really increase the efficiency of a plant. Well, some of the problems that you get with geothermal is that if you go down to the geysers, it's extremely noisy. But maybe it's out away from people, so it doesn't bother. But they are very noisy. You have a lot of piping. The source, your boiler in the earth does cool down as you draw up steam. You do have to keep drilling new wells. And sometimes you have problems with what's coming out is corrosive. Has a lot of maybe hydrogen sulfide in it, so it'll smell. Sometimes there's rocks, small rocks coming up in the steam, and it's not too good for the turbine having these. You got to have something to catch the rocks first before they hit the turbine. So that there are problems, but it works, and it's a good thing. Now, after the other ways that's figured you might be able to do it is if just go down and hit hot rocks. There might not be water down there, but hot rocks. Pump down water and so that it'll heat the water up, and then, well, you pump it down, you'd have to maybe put in explosives and crack the rocks so that they got so that water would flow through them, and pump in water in one place and then have it steam up and collect it somewhere else. And that's another possible way you might do it.
Is any of that being done that you know of?
Not that I know of, no. Those are all plans. By the way, Hawaii is doing quite a bit in geothermal right now. They have several test projects going, because naturally they have volcanoes over there. And in fact, they're doing a lot of different energy things in Hawaii. They don't have oil, and it's a long ways from things. Okay, any other comments about geothermal? Right.
There's a geothermal project going on in Ephrata right now.
Where?
Ephrata, Washington. They're going to do some district heating, and they're thinking about putting in a greenhouse and using geothermal to heat the greenhouse.
Okay, that's another thing that has been used quite a few places is where you have hot springs, which are quite prevalent in the western part of the country, is to just use the hot water to heat a greenhouse or something. And this, of course, can be used anywhere where there's a steam plant, where you have this surplus of hot water. In fact, in Europe and other countries, they will build their power plants usually right in town or right at the edge of town, and then all that waste heat in the water is used to heat buildings. And this is done someplace. I know in Tacoma, was it St. Regis? Their stinky pulp mill down there. But at any rate, they have their own boilers, and some of their water that after they've used it is circulated through buildings in Tacoma to heat some of that. And this could be done and save a lot of energy that way. So many ways that if we just think about it, we could make use of extra things. I know there's a geothermal project over in Raft River in Idaho too, and a lot of places there, they're checking it out.
In some areas that don't have the natural geothermal service there, I know some people are tracking like aquifers underneath the water and mapping out how fast the water moves and where it's moving. And I know in one place they're taking up the water and they're from the aquifer and then using excess waste heat that they get in the summertime and heating the water and then putting the water back down underground, and then they know where that water is going to be during the winter and then pump it up again and use that hot water for hot water heating. So it's kind of like making their own geothermal.
Mm-hmm. What's an aquifer?
An aquifer is underwater.
Underground water.
Water table.
You'd have to put down a lot of heat probably, or you're going to lose an awful lot down in the ground there, I would think, before you get it back out. But a lot of these things are possible. And I think in the future, we're going to have to look more to your local area as to what you can do there, rather than expecting a big nuclear plant or something to send the electricity to you. That look at your area and see what can be done there. Some places might be able to use geothermal, other wind and whatnot.
There's a point of interest. This project she's talking about is being done at the University of Minnesota with their St. Paul campus.
Oh. So where's the local aquifer that they're doing that?
Right underground of them.
Campus?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. There's some interesting places in Idaho where the Big Lost and the Little Lost rivers, which are pretty good-sized rivers coming out of the mountains, come down about at Arco and that area where all these nuclear testing stations are, but they just disappear into the rocks. I mean, these are big rivers, just gone, and then they come out about, what is it, 100 or 150 miles farther at a place called Thousand Springs, right on the... where the Snake River is. There's a Snake River is in a deep canyon right there, and coming right out of the walls of the canyon are just springs, just shooting water out. And this is where the river water from the Lost Rivers is coming back into the Snake River again. But there they use that for growing fish because it's such good water. And a lot of good fish hatcheries, or not fish hatcheries, but also commercial fish operations using that water. Well, the next thing I would like to mention a little bit about is hydro, and those who, being here at Holden, that's how your electricity is being generated. Are you all aware of the hydro plant, that the electricity here at Holden comes from Copper Creek, the water comes from Copper Creek, and there's a generating plant just across the covered bridge. And when you think of that, it's an extremely efficient, nice way to generate electricity. I believe we're getting about a capacity of 360 kilowatts, isn't it, from that plant?
I've heard that, yeah.
Which is a lot. And just from that little plant. And it doesn't seem like that much water flowing through there. Now, basically what it takes to generate a watt of electricity is that you need 100 gallons, or 1 gallon per minute, falling 100 feet. So, when you think that's to get a watt, that's a lot of water to light a 100 watt light bulb, and to run a home. But nevertheless, there's a lot of water flowing around. The North America currently is the greatest producer of hydroelectric electricity. In the United States, we are getting about half as much hydro as we could possibly get. And if we were to dam up the remaining rivers and whatnot, we could probably double our supply of hydroelectric power. They are diverting some huge rivers. Nobody lives up there at all. It's way up there. Some huge rivers and making them, channeling them over to where they can catch them as they come falling out of the high Arctic land. and they're going to generate electricity and wire that down to the eastern part of Canada. Africa and South America have greater potential for hydroelectric than North America does. And they have not developed very much of it. Also, there are countries that don't have much oil or coal. So that there's a great potential. In fact, if all the world's hydropower was being used, or had been developed, that would produce about as much energy as we are using in the world today. So that you look at it that way, you know, it sounds fine. There's a lot of energy available there that hydropower could supply all the energy that's being used in the world today. That it's potential, it's possible. Of course, there are environmental aspects to hydropower too. You have to dam up the river or do something to it. The fish and the dams make reservoirs and that. Are most of you aware of how you produce electricity at a dam or not? Or should I mention quickly what happens? Okay, I will. Okay, to generate electricity, really all you are using the water for is to turn a turbine. And of course, a turbine is just to get the shaft moving, so then turn the generator, right? And then get the electricity. So to get what you get out of it, it depends upon the head or the height of the water. You know, you're aware that the pressure at the bottom depends upon how high the water is, not how much water goes behind the dam, but how high it is. So it depends upon the head and then the amount of flow that you have going through. So you want a lot of water flowing and a high head would be the best. Okay, well, the water is intake at the intake, water entry up at the intake, which is usually just a pipe up high. And the water goes in and it just rushes through and comes out at the penstock and turns a turbine, which and then it turns to the generator and you have your electricity. Well, the dam, of course, is there for two reasons, at least. One of them is to give you the head, that if the river is just gently flowing down, you don't have the head. So you build the dam to make the head. And then, of course, the other reason is that, like you have here at Holden, is that you have plenty of water in the summer right now. You're not diverting very much of the water at all, and we aren't here. It's for electricity. But in the wintertime, then Copper Creek essentially practically dries up, and you do not have enough water flowing to generate electricity. So if you have a dam, then you save the water for in the wintertime and use it then. Of course, another wonderful thing about hydropower, and I guess I should mention that in the United States, about 4% of our total energy comes from hydropower. About 12% of our electricity comes from hydropower in the United States. Now, if you live in Washington, how much of our electricity comes from hydropower?
90%?
Pretty close. It was 88%, and I think it probably still is. About 88% of our electricity comes from hydropower, which is an awful lot. And that's why we've had such cheap electricity out here. Because once you have a dam in place, there is not much to operating a hydropower. For instance, the Mossy Rock Dam, which is 300 feet above, or is it 600 feet? It's a very high dam. There's one person operating that dam most of the time. And that's all. You go to a steam plant or a nuclear plant, and there's people all over the place all the time that have to be operating it. And I don't know, we have somebody that's in charge of our hydro plant, but they're not there other than if there's trouble, are they? So there's not much to running on once you get them in. And you can produce electricity very reasonably. I guess you're aware that Holden has in a proposal to put in a bigger plant. Well, actually, this is a bigger plant. It's about the same size plant, only down on Railroad Creek, down at between 6 and 7 miles in the creek. And there, of course, they get enough running to generate all electricity all winter long, which is when you would want more electricity here so that you could use to heat the buildings electrically. Well, Lowhead
high head water is what we have been talking about so far, where you have a high dam or a, well, you don't really need a dam, or all you need is to catch the water like we do here, just a diversion and have it in a pipe or something that starts up high and you generate it down low.
So they don't have a dam here? They aren't damming up with Copper Creek?
Well, they have a dam that's probably 6 inches high up there.
Well, just to save the water?
Just enough to flow the water over to their pipe.
Okay.
That's all they have. And you'll find this other places too, those of you from Seattle area, Snoqualmie Falls. Anybody aware of Snoqualmie Falls? No? Okay, all they have is, I suppose maybe it's more than a couple feet high, but it's not very high, it's just enough to channel the water over into their penstock to go down, down to the generator. And there what they did was they drilled a shaft right through basalt back in 1898. And put in a generator underground, right at the below the, right essentially below the falls, or below the top of the falls. It's right in the basalt, and then they have a little tunnel that lets the water run out at the bottom down there. It comes out just at the side of the Snoqualmie Falls. So, if you have a situation like that, you aren't even really changing the river at all. You're catching the water. Well, you're changing it away. The water isn't going over the falls. It's going through there. So. You do change that part. But certainly it's cheap to operate, it's clean, it's safe for the most part, unless you happen to be living below Teton Dam. Anybody heard of Teton Dam? 6 years ago over in Idaho, they built, they'd already built the dam. And it was a 300-foot high dam, no trivial structure. I was there about 3 weeks ago, saw what was left of it. But anyway, the water, and it had a power plant and everything there, but the water somehow started seeping through underneath the dam and bubbling up, and once it went, within a few minutes, this whole dam just washed out and came tumbling down the Teton Valley, and I guess 11 people drowned and devastated the whole valley there, and then flooded out all kinds of the Snake River Valley before it essentially got caught by American Falls Dam downstream a little bit. Yeah,
there must be a life expectancy on these dams too, and I think that's part of what might concern me about dams, both in terms of silting in, but I suppose that depends upon your river and the dam itself, and then the deterioration of the dams. And I understand that there are a number of the dams that are in pretty poor condition now.
There are many of them. However, this was a brand new dam. Yes. This was the first time it had water in it. So this was a brand new dam. They were filling it for the first time. And the way it went. And it is an awesome sight to see that dam now. Because it's a very steep canyon. And they built the spillway. You got your land. Your land comes like this. Except that right here there was the canyon. And the dam then was up above the general slope so that it filled the valley. So the spillway was right up here on the shelf, right above the canyon. So now you see this big spillway sitting up there on the top of a canyon.
Was it an earth-filled dam?
It was an earth-filled dam. And the canyon was not that terribly wide. And it essentially washed out the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Not much left. But as you mentioned, yes, there is life expectancy on certain dams. Some of them they figure will last 100 years, and we're going to have our rivers just going down in steps, that the reservoirs will get filled out. Now, in a way, that doesn't affect the generation of electricity unless, well, it affects it in that you can't store the water, that you'd have to generate it as it came free-flowing. You would still be able to generate. But yeah, you'll just have a lot of flat land eventually where these things fill up. And of course it does affect the mouth of the river too, where the used to build up deltas, and now the silt is not getting down to that area, so it's going to be washing out instead of building up. But then there's the other problem that they had in Estes. Well, they always have these out in Estes Park, it seems. The earth-filled dam gave way up there just this... That was just the summer, wasn't it? Not more than a month ago or so. And again, the water comes rushing out. And there's What do they estimate? Half of the earth-filled, smaller earth-filled dams at any rate, are really unsafe, that if you get more water than, so that they really do fill up, that they're liable to just go. And extremely dangerous.
What kind of dams are there? You mentioned earth-filled. I've never heard, I imagine concrete or something else is used.
Yeah, earth-filled, of course, is where you just depend upon the weight of the earth and the rocks and everything, and that they're going to, you know, be packed with clay and gravels and whatnot, so that the water, you don't want the water soaking through them like sand, so that they, if once it soaks in there, then you have that pressure. So you build them usually narrow at the top and then broad at the bottom, just to hold the water back. Well, then there's concrete dams. Again, you can build them usually in a narrow canyon where, such as the Hoover Dam, I guess that's the one that most people would be aware of, where you, there's different types of concrete dams. There can be concrete dams where, again, it's just the weight of the concrete that is holding the water back, essentially, that you build it with enough concrete and wide enough at the base and that it's holding the water back, and of course at the top you don't need more than a sliver, you know, at the top, because there's not much pressure there. Then dams like Mossy Rock Dam, which is near Tacoma, Tacoma City Light gets from, and it's a high dam, this is over 300 feet high, is a thin dam, but it's built sort of like a parabola, concave, so that the pressure of the water goes into the concrete, and then the concrete is pushing into the rock on the side of the canyon. Of course, to have something like that, you need good solid rock on the sides of the canyon. So the type of dam you build depends upon the locale you're in and what the ground and the rocks are. So those are the main kinds of dams. The dams on the Missouri River, I think they're all earth-filled there, of course. Basically they're low, quite low head dams, but not really a low head either. Well, there's low head dams, where you essentially just build the water up enough to sort of make use of the flow of the water. And the little paddle wheel out here is sort of a thing like that, where it's not the most efficient way of using catching the water, but it's a low head facility. And there are many places where that can be done. I know in Idaho Falls, they just put in several right on the Snake River, where they have maybe 10 feet to 20 feet at most head, so that you're basically just catching the flow of the river, but with a little bit of height on it. Okay, well, as I mentioned, South America and Africa have great potential for hydroelectric. In fact, Israel was once proposing, and I doubt that it will happen, but they were going to take water from the Mediterranean and flow it over to the Dead Sea. Now, the Dead Sea is over 1,000 feet below sea level. That's a lot of fall, 1,000 feet. But I think you can see the problems that they would run into, not just in building it, but with other nations, and that they would be, if you start doing that in any great quantity, you're going to start filling up the Dead Sea slowly. Although it would take a long time, because there's a lot of evaporation going on there, but not only would you be filling it up, but the water you're bringing in is salty, and so you'd have a problem there. Well, Egypt has even a bigger plan. I forget the name of the place right now, but it's only a couple hundred feet below sea level, but it's an enormous place. And they were going to bring in water from the Mediterranean and generate electricity, catching the water with the head there. And of course that's all in their own land, and I guess there wouldn't be too many other people to object to it, but they figured they could generate electricity there for a long time, and it essentially would evaporate about as fast as they brought it in. Of course, now this could have an effect on the weather in local areas, you do things like that. Well, I guess the other thing I wanted to mention about hydropower
which is so wonderful about it, is that we don't use our electricity uniform over the day. That usually during the night there's comparatively little electricity being used. You get up in the morning, especially in the wintertime, you turn on your lights, take a shower, hot water, turn up the heat on the house, everything. And now there needs to be electricity. Well, if you're operating a nuclear plant, there isn't much you can do to vary the amount of power you're going to generate. You're pretty much generating at a level power, so-called base load. And pretty much the same way with a coal plant. You can cool those down, but you can't all of a sudden put on electricity. So power companies have to have ways to give that surge of electricity, or else they have to generate at a higher level and let it go to waste when nobody wants to use it. Well, hydropower is extremely nice for that, because all you have to do is open the valve and you got your turbine going, so that they are used an awful lot for just giving these peak time power. So the dams, like Mossy Rock, it doesn't flow water through it all that often. You know, if they were to operate it at full capacity, they could drain the reservoir in a very short time. And that's true of a lot of the river dams, that the capacity of the generators there is much, much greater than what you could handle just from the river flow. But that's so that they can really put out the electricity at peak times and then shut it off again at other times.
When you have power from a nuclear plant, for example, and you have a base load like you're talking about, what happens if there were a real drop in demand for some reason or another, everything was turned off for some period of time? What happens to that energy?
Well, you have to send it through the cooling tower and dissipate it. As I mentioned, when you have your steam, which all a nuclear plant does is produce steam, really. It's no different in that sense than a coal plant. You just have the reactor is the boiler to give you the steam. And if you're not going to use it, you just send it out to the cooling tower. And 2/3 of the heat in the steam goes out the cooling tower, or however you're cooling it, as it is. So if you're not, there's no demand, you just cool it.
Because aren't all of your electric power stations connected to a grid, and all of these things are very much refined to, so that it's very rarely that a plant that produces the base power is ever needs to be shut off, because they use the hydroelectric and other sources to well, be the variance.
They are connected in tremendous grids, and there are industries that contract for low cost power that only can use it when they don't need it on there, so that they're under a time clock type thing where they'll use their electricity when it's not needed other places. However, I know that last summer, and then I think again this summer, that the steam plant at Centralia in Washington, where we have a coal mine, was not operating most of the summer because the base load was down so low that they didn't even need to operate that.
Also, in this part of the country, the spring and summer runoff from the high mountains and the snow, the dams produce more electric power than is needed.
So you can't store as much as you'd like, so that you can't just hold it in the dam. You have to let some of it out, and again, you can produce more. The aluminum companies, of course, they get a lot of good rates on electricity to use it at certain times when there's a surplus or land.
Well, the overall load in this grid is quite predictable, really, from day to day.
Oh, yes. They have it down pretty much. They know it exactly what minute people are going to be turning things on and which day of the week. I've seen the printouts that certain electric companies have on just exactly what it varies from day to day and hour to hour and whatnot, and days of the week and holidays, and so that they have a pretty good idea exactly what they're going to need. And then, of course, by what the temperature is outside, they got to build that in.
I was back in New York when they had the blackout, when it was 65 or so.
Uh-huh.
63, I've forgotten that. Some years back, and all this eastern seaboard went out, and that was a horrible thing. It was winter, and there were 4 or 5 days that there was no power. And this was back up in Kingston, New York, and, you know, sort of a remote area. People were cold and hungry, and you couldn't cook. Very interesting.
Yeah, we don't realize how dependent we are on electricity. We say, well, we heat by coal or oil or gas or whatever, but it, almost every one of these things, if the electricity goes off, your furnace does not work. I know that happened to us one winter. Electricity went off in a snowstorm, and it was off for several days. Luckily, it wasn't off. We were on one power company, and just across the creek, which is about a block away, they were on a different power company, and theirs wasn't off. So I ran a wire over there and disconnected our furnace and just plugged the furnace in. And boy, it made a big difference just to have a little bit of heat. You know, the house made a big difference. Well, let's see. We're running close to the end. We can either have more discussion, or I have a bunch of other more far out energy sources that might be in the future. But I don't want to cut off discussion with this.
Tell us about some far out ones.
How about some far out ones? Okay, I'll quickly mention a few. You ever heard of OTEC, Ocean Thermal Energy Conversion? See, some of you, I know this always draws the energy experts, so that I'm telling people things that they know more about probably than I do. But at any rate, in certain parts of the ocean, especially in the tropical areas, the water on the top is considerably warmer than the water at the bottom. And there are proposals that you will use that temperature differential, the difference in temperature, to run a generator. And basically what you need is some sort of ammonia or something that will boil at the top temperature, and then you pump up the water from below to, after you use that then as a steam to turn a generator, and then cool it with water that you pumped up from below. And this actually was done in Cuba about 1930. They had a 22 kilowatt plant. That's pretty small, but that was actually operating until a hurricane came along and took it away. And these are being proposed, and there are tremendous problems in it. However, Hawaii currently is testing a 50 kilowatt plant, which is supposed to cost, I don't know, they say only $2 million at this.
Is that the one that was just on a ship? It's just.
I think so.
Ship? Yeah, I was on that 2 years ago.
Uh-huh. Well, to get an idea what a 50 kilowatt plant is, that's about what you could get using a small car engine. I mean, you could use a small car engine, and you could generate electricity at about that. So you see, that's pretty small in the sense of how much electricity you're going to get there. Now, Lockheed has made a design for a 250 megawatt plant. Now that's about a fourth or a fifth of a big nuclear plant or a big steam plant. And what their design calls for is a 3,000 foot deep pipe going down 3,000 feet. That's a long ways. 90 feet in diameter. And they figure they need a flow of 1,500 cubic meters a second, which is comparable to the flow of the Missouri River. Now that's the type, because you see, you only got a 35 to 40 degree difference in temperature differential when you go down that deep. That's all. It's not much difference in temperature. So you need tremendous volumes then to get much heat change, because you need the heat interchange there. Well, there's other problems. There's the weather problem, like the hurricane. How do you anchor these things out where the temperature differentials are? And the other problem is, where is the temperature differential? Well, it's down in the tropics, and you don't really need the electricity there. How do you get the wires to shore? And then besides, they have hydro possibilities in most of those places anyway, which is much cheaper. So it's a possibility, but I don't see it having much possibility. I mean, that it's really going to be practical. Other possibilities, they talk about wave power. If you've ever been to the ocean and the waves come in, you know there's a lot of energy there. And
they're trying to think of ways, the so-called nodding duck things of that the waves come and they push the thing, and that, you know, that gives you some energy that you can transfer somewhere. But the massive amounts of the material you need, and how do you anchor them down and then transfer it into an energy that you can make use of. And the corrosiveness of the salt, which is also the problem with the ocean thermal things. So that's expensive. Another one, magnetohydrodynamics. Have you heard of that one? Which, anybody know something about that? Nobody? Well, I don't know much either, but it's the study of the flow of a conducting fluid or gas or plasma in a magnetic field. And what's proposed is that when you burn coal in a steam plant, you don't throw in coal and have the clinkers come out like you did on the train. What they do is they grind it up and pulverize it so that it's just like talcum powder or finer. And then when you start the furnace, you just blow in, you spray in oil, fuel oil to start it, so it's just like a fuel oil furnace. And then as the temperature builds up, you just spray in the talcum powder fuel, coal. And that's the way it's burned in there, so it's essentially burning like an oil furnace. Well, if you grind this up and get the coal hot enough, it gets ionized, and if you send this through, then blast it through a magnetic field, you can collect the ions, and that's really electricity anyway, so that you get your electricity direct without actually heating water. Well, then after that, then they want to take the water or use the remaining energy that didn't come out in the ions there, and then heat water and steam and then generate some more electricity there. Well, they figure this would be more efficient, that you could get, instead of the 30 or 33% I was talking about, that you could maybe get up to 50 or better percent efficiency out of the energy in your coal. Now, there's tremendous problems in the pollution. Well, not the pollution, but there's pollution too, but the gathering of, when these ions come, there's going to be coal dust and other stuff, and keeping things clean, and you have to put in a, what they call a seed material to get it ionized right, and then you got to collect that again and recirculate it, and then there just seems to be all kinds of problems. But they've got an operating plant in Russia. In fact, they started operating one in 1971, only they're not using coal, they're using natural gas. And doesn't give you it hasn't become efficient. But it is a possibility. Another thing they've talked about is superconducting power lines just to transport electricity. That when you send all electricity on a power line, you lose at least 10% of the electricity, and depending upon the distance, you lose more. And so one way is to change it into direct current. You got all the ions going the same way, so you aren't heating up the wire going back and forth as much. And they do that. They will, if they're going to have a long run from, say, Washington down to California, I think there is a line where they will convert the electricity to direct, send it down, and then reconvert it back to alternating. Of course, you lose in each of those conversions.